The Marine and the Hippie is a weekly conversation about current events aimed at presenting alternative viewpoints while looking for common ground. We are the Marine and the Hippie.
Welcome to the Marine and the Hippie. This is Dialogue 33, the season of winter. I am the Hippie coming at you from Kusadashi, Turkey. Today we are talking about kind of the season of winter as a metaphor. And what winter represents is the season of the wicked, of the selfish eye or the wicked eye. And a lot of the time our show really focuses and our ideas focus on doing better for us, for the whole community, we the people or the whole. And it seems like we're moving away from that and we're moving towards a society in which we have to do more for the eye. And I'm going to give an analogy using dogs. I have a dog. Her name is Gezi. She's a little Jack Russell Terrier. And when I got her, it was fall, like the end of summer, beginning of fall where I live. And I live in a pretty warm climate, so winter doesn't really roll around until the middle of December. And when I first got her, her best friend was this big, 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 big white dog. Gezi's 6 kilo. This dog must have been 40 or 50 kilo. I mean, so we're talking like a huge dog. And they were like best friends. They get into each other's face, into each other's butts. But this dog was a street dog. And the moment the weather changed, that dog was no longer her friend, because the dog went from the season of summer and fall where everything was plentiful. So the dog didn't have to worry about being cold, didn't have to worry about food, didn't have to worry about getting love from people. It got all of its needs met. And then suddenly, winter came. And when winter came, its needs weren't being met. It wasn't getting enough love from others. It didn't have as much food because not as many people were walking down the street. So it went into survival mode. And it seems like that's where society is moving towards. We're moving towards a society of survival mode of the individual, as opposed to kind of a community mode of the harvest, of coming together and building something. And I'm not really sure where that's going
to
lead.
You know, I know that people will point back to the 50s as this golden era or whatever. 50s and 60s post-war prosperity was a real thing in this country, where a person could indeed live what was called the American dream, work hard. They'd put food on the table. They'd be able to save money for a car. They'd be able to save money for a house. They'd be able to save money for their kids' education. Not like their kids needed education, because higher education was, for the most part, funded at 100% for those people to get in. And education was a bit more competitive back then. But at the same time, if you went to school, you basically paid almost nothing to go get educated, so that you had people's parents saying that they could work part-time jobs in the summertime and fully finance their education through part-time work as a waitress or whatever. Slowly but surely, those opportunities that were very broadly spread across the entire society shrunk down to a smaller and smaller group of people, so that by the time I was a kid, only a few people could actually experience that sort of life. Most people had two parents that worked, if they had two parents at all, and a lot of people that only had one parent were slowly sinking into poverty, out of the middle class and into poverty, so that nowadays, with the millennials and especially the Gen Z people talking about how they can't afford a house ever, how they'll never be able to even have kids because they can't afford to do any of that stuff, the median experience of the generations that are coming up into the workforce now is one where they can't afford to even live, no matter how hard they work, except for a very few select handful of people who happen to live on either the East Coast or the West Coast, who happen to be involved with either high finance or with technology. Those are the only people that seem to be doing any good outside of the, you know, billionaire elite. And so it's getting to the point where, you know, a small group of people are insulating themselves against the vast majority of the population, who is slowly but surely, if they're not already there, sinking not only into poverty in this lifetime, but also poverty on a generational level. And this is where we're at in this country, where people that had great prospects, you know, 20, 25 years ago, now have zero prospects.
Yeah, so it seems like the metaphor is correct, that people who used to have things provided for them, or it was easier to access the things that they needed, suddenly are no longer able to get these things and no longer have them provided because of the gap between the rich and the poor. That gap is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. We used to think that $1 million was a lot of money. Now it's $1 billion. Well, if the median wage just only went from $20,000 to $40,000, and wealth went from $1 million to $1 billion, the ability of survival, or the ability of getting out of of having prosperity or not falling into poverty becomes huge or becomes something very distant for almost everybody, as opposed to the possibility being available to most.
The things that subtract from our wages on a day-to-day basis continue to grow while our wages remain stagnant. And so we have more and more demands on our wages, what meager wages we make, even, you know, well-paying jobs. You know, $30,000 used to be seen as a pretty decent well-paying job. Nowadays, $30,000 basically means you can't afford your rent. And, you know, you have to go on food stamps at a certain point. And so while the rich, the billionaire class continues to make more and more and more money, that money comes from somewhere. And if one person makes $1 billion, that's $1 billion that's taken from countless number of poor people through wage theft and whatnot. So we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about this, the winner of our discontent here on the Marine and the Hippie Dialogue 33. And we'll be right back after the break. Hey, this is Doc.
And this is Dylan.
And you're listening to Marine and the Hippie.
Thank you for listening to Dialogue 33, the season of winter here on the Marine and the Hippie. When we left, we're talking about the disparity between the rich and the poor and the ability to achieve success and how much money is kind of being taken from us out of our wages for more things. Cars are more expensive, gas is more expensive, our insurances are more expensive. And when I say insurances, I add an S because we have to pay into multiple different pots. And all of these are take and don't give to us, while the people who have the wealth are becoming wealthier. And that disparity is becoming very scary. And it's setting a tone for survival only. And last week we talked about what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin with Kyle Rittenhouse. And putting him aside, I want to take a look at the judge. And the judge has made the actions of the hungry allowed, viable. It means that if you're hungry and you're stealing for your food, that's kind of where we're moving. And we're moving, it seems like we're moving towards a society in which it's going to be a dog-eat-dog or a take only. Take what we want when we want it, because the middle class is so squeezed that it's no longer about happy dogs playing in a dog park, just having fun. It's about some dogs being hungry and wanting to take from the other dog that's eating its food.
Speaking of the judge and the Rittenhouse verdict, once again, it's really important to remember that the only reason that Kyle Rittenhouse walks free today is because he had really well-paid, high-powered lawyers that were paid by someone else. They weren't paid by Rittenhouse and his family, because Rittenhouse and his family couldn't afford that kind of legal representation. Those lawyers were paid for by well-connected, very deep-pocketed right-wing interests who basically set Rittenhouse up with world-class legal defense to help him get off on that case. And so to amend what you said there, Dylan, and perhaps you'll accept this as a friendly amendment, the judge will justify, you know, survival-type behavior among people that have money to afford excellent legal defense. If you are a poor person and you go steal a loaf of bread, you're probably going to experience worse penalties, you know, worse results in a court of law than you would if you were wealthy and didn't need to steal the bread in the first place, but stole just because it was fun.
Maybe. I'm not sure if I agree with the complete amendment. I think that really when we're looking at a society and a system of law that governs that society, we have two paths. We have the path of logic. We have the path of violence as really our only two vehicles to solve problems. And I think we're just swaying back to the other. We've spent about 100 years really trying to use logic as our main means of solving problems. Maybe it didn't look like that outside of our nation, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, the Gulf Wars. But within our nation, we tried to develop a society that wasn't violent in solving problems between citizens, between you and me. Before, we did that. I mean, it was celebrated. Our senators would have épées on their waist and would say, I challenge you to a duel, or to single fire handguns and go out and do a shooting. And we celebrate the Wild West in movies and film, like Rust, that where Alec Baldwin killed one of his employees, because we celebrate the use of weapons. We celebrate the use of guns and swords and violence as a means of solving problems, as opposed to logic. And our show is about logic. Our show is about putting our differences aside to come to a consensus, or believing that just because I have an opinion, like was just demonstrated, it may be different than Doc's, and that's fine. We don't get into a fist fight about it, because that's not how it should be. But we're moving into a time where you're going to get into a fender bender, and you're going to pull your gun out, and you're going to put it on your side, and you're going to walk out and be like, you just bumped into my car. And if the other person gets out of their car with the gun, you know how you're going to solve the problem. And the person who doesn't have a gun, well, we know what happens to them.
I think that's a fundamentally different question, though, than what verdict you get, what jury result you get in a court of law. We might be moving to a society, and I could agree with you here, that seems more violent. There was recently a story, just to underscore what you just said, about some woman in a SUV or something like that that tapped a motorcycle. The motorcyclist followed her to her house and blew her away. She was pregnant, you know, so he got two counts of murder rather than one. But whether or not he gets off of that, I think definitely depends on the resources that he has available to him, whether or not a high-powered lawyer can make that seem like it's some sort of justifiable homicide, like they did in the Rittenhouse case, or if they just basically throw him under the bus and say, well, you're a psycho killer and you need to be segregated from society. I think that the defining characteristic going forward in our courts of law will be the resources that you can bring to bear on that question. And if you happen to have better lawyers, high-powered lawyers, you're going to stay completely out of jail and be able to act with impunity in society like Rittenhouse did. And if you don't have good lawyers, or if you have a public defender, you're going to go to jail for a very, very long time if you resolve things with violence.
Maybe. Or law is going to be put on the fence for a while, because the amount of people who are applying for the jobs as police officers is smaller. So there's not that there's not enough police, there's just not enough people filling the positions that are available. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And that creates an environment in which if you have one shooting in a city or two shootings in a city, that's fine. What Doc says, I agree with. But if every interaction, every disagreement between one individual and another individual is solved with violence, then what's put by the wayside is the justice system. It's not going to depend on how much money you have, because there's not going to be enough people to arrest the people who are causing the violence. When we come back, we'll explore this a little bit more, this season of Winter Dialogue 33 with the Marine and the Hippie.
Hey, this is Dylan with the Marine and the Hippie. I'm the Hippie.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Marine and the Hippie Dialogue 33. I am the Marine, and I'm here with the Hippie. And we're talking today about the attitude of survival that most Americans are finding themselves entering into. And as you can imagine, when you find yourself in a survival situation, you start to get desperate. You start to do things that you wouldn't otherwise do when things were good and resources were plenty. You start thinking about, you know, what banks can I knock over, or like what bread can I steal when I absolutely need to feed my kids. And, you know, you're going to run afoul of the law in that situation, because the law, it seems more and more these days, is designed specifically to protect property, which you are attempting to confiscate from the original owner into your own pocket. And so a lot of people are getting frustrated with the old methods of resolving conflicts in society, where we would talk to a cop, get some police officer to intervene for us. The police officer would come in as a peace officer to try to, you know, make sure that it doesn't escalate into a more violent circumstance. A lot of times the cops are the ones escalating the problem. It usually ends up in an arrest, perhaps an incarceration, and maybe charges. And sometimes it ends up going to prison. And this is the society that we're getting into nowadays, where we have fewer and fewer resources available that are being demanded by more and more people, and the system seems set up and rigged that those resources tend to go to those who already have resources far more often than they go to those without resources. And I'm not really sure how we get around that situation and prevent a vicious spiral in this country that just goes down.
I don't know either, because I'm not sure if it's possible. I think we've just decided that we're going to go into this season and see where it lands. Because you bring up a point where you're saying, you know, the person who's hungry and they steal a loaf of bread, we say, well, stealing's wrong. Well, committing suicide is wrong too. And if I die of hunger and I had the ability to steal a loaf of bread, which is right and which is wrong? Committing suicide by hunger or stealing the loaf of bread?
Okay, so in my teaching of ethics, this is something I came across. No less of a great personage than St. Thomas Aquinas himself, the person that wrote Summa Theologica, okay, that's the name of his book, Summa Theologica, wrote that it is a moral responsibility for those with more than they need to give the excess to those people who don't have enough. It's a moral duty. And if that person does not, if that person stores away that stuff in their larder or their safe or whatever, it is the moral responsibility for those who are hungry to go and steal that bread for the preservation of life, because their life is more important than that person storing up bread against, you know, some sort of hunger or whatever. So that's the answer to your question. Morally and ethically speaking, it is moral for me to go steal that food to preserve my life if they've got too much and I don't have enough.
Right. And the way the system's set up is even more fucked up, because what happens is if I steal the food and I get caught and I get arrested, what do I get? I get food. I get shelter. I get clothing. I get to be brought to not a very safe place, but a relatively safe place called a jail or a prison. And I get to spend time there, and I don't have to worry about hunger anymore. So if I try to be part of society and I steal bread and somebody catches me, they're going to be violent towards me. So I'm going to be violent towards them back, just like the dogs in the neighborhood now, as they change from their summer coats to their winter coat. Because as resources become more scarce, survival becomes more important. And survival is about putting I first, putting me first, and saying, I need to survive, period. And I'm going to do it by all costs. And if that means every time we get into an interaction with somebody because we don't like them or because they're being aggressive towards us, well, I'm going to snap at them. But if the only way that we can be aggressive towards each other is at the end of a sword or at the end of a gun, then that's how it's going to be. It's not going to be, oh, wait, you have a gun, so I'm going to back off. It's going to be, oh, you have a gun, I need to arm myself as well for this altercation. And that's what we're building. And that's what the season of winter looks like. It's where it's going. And it looks like we're going to go into a very, I don't know, scary time.
I just want to say that it is policy, bad policy specifically, that got us to the position we're in right now. It is the fact that business people and lawyers were hired to create public policy in our government rather than actual political scientists and theorists. So they are concerned about something completely different than the public good or the general welfare. They're concerned about a bottom line. Hey, the skills that make a good business person make a terrible public policy person. And vice versa. You know, you can't be good at business and worry about profits and losses and also worry about, you know, constructing roads all over the country. It doesn't work. Those two things are mutually exclusive. But those are the people that we put in charge of our government, and they create terrible policy. And what we're going to have to do is get rid of the people that are making the terrible policy and put people that make good policy in, or we don't have a chance in hell as a society.
And policy are the rules. And if you want a lawless society, vote your feeling. Vote for the person that you think is coolest and hippest and makes you feel good. But if you want a society that has rules that do the best for the most and make an environment that's relatively safe or as safe as it can be, then you have to vote not feelings, but logic. So the logic is policy in this case. So what Doc's saying is true. If we vote a TV show star, Matthew McConaughey, maybe in Texas, to be governor, as opposed to, let's say, somebody who spent their life devoted to actual policy and to actual political science and theory, then what we get is, oh, I feel good about this person because I like his movies. And that leads us to a violent, because at the end, we're getting people who are unwilling to make the hard choice. And the hard choice sometimes is making rules that affect the bottom line. And when we're talking about the bottom line, we're talking about profit. Anyway, Doc, why don't you finish this off today?
I'll simply say, not only unwilling, but unable. They don't have the ability or the skill necessary to make policy that takes into account all of the people that are going to be affected by it, the long-term costs and benefits of the program. They don't have those skills. They have the skills necessary to convince you that the character that they're acting as is really them and what you're seeing on TV is true. That's what their skills are. A true policymaker, a true philosopher, a true political theorist will be able to determine good policy for the society based on the justice of the policy or justice of the rules, whereas a person who lacks that will determine it based on something completely different. And what we need is a society based on justice, not on popularity, not on getting reelected. And until we get that, you know, in society, we're just going to continue to decline, go into more survival mode, dog-eat-dog mode, to go back to the original analogy. And that's where we're going to be as a society. And if we want that, you know, we're going to continue to just do what we're doing. If we don't want that, we got to do something different. So with that, you've been listening to Marine and the Hippie, Dialogue 33. and I am the Marine, and I'm here with the Hippie, and we will be back next week where we will have another interesting topic. Until that time, if you want to contact us, check us out, marineandhippie.com, where we got all our socials and our Gmail and everything like that. You can check us out there. You can also read Dylan's blog. We're going to have the addresses coming up at the end of the show. So I'm the Marine.
I'm the Hippie. Thanks for listening to Dialogue 33. Ciao.
Take care.
You're listening to The Marine and the Hippie. I'm Dylan. I'm the Hippie from Turkey. And let me just tell you, Kolay Gelsin. May it be easy. Peace.
For more information on The Marine, follow Doc at Supernova_Earth on Twitter and listen to the Supernova Earth Show on Spotify. For more information on The Hippie, follow Dylan at GeziandMe on Twitter and read his blog at observationsfromthespectrum.org.